COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Was an orange ever an orange?
Why does half of the word helicopter keep spiraling off into other words?
And what does Alice in Wonderland have to do with sexting?
Pick up a mocktail, sit back and chillax. Join us down the rabbit hole on another Words Unraveled. Welcome to another episode of Words Unraveled. I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Words from Hell, and creator of the Useless Etymology blog.
And I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words. And in this edition, we're discussing portmanteaus, rebracketing, and a little something called metathesis.
And if you don't know what those words mean, don't worry. It's more or less word mashups and a little bit of word rearranging.
Exactly. And let's start off with the first one that I mentioned. Portmanteaus, because people will have come across them in day-to-day life, even if they haven't known that the things that they've come across are indeed portmanteaus. Actually, Jess, you come across portmanteaus more often than most.
I do. My name is actually a portmanteau. My unmarried name is F-A-R-R-I-S, and then I married a Greek man whose last name is Z-A-F-E-R-I-S. So in order to avoid being Jess Zafaris Ferris or Jess Ferris Zafaris, we just smashed them together to make a new spelling.
And that's exactly what a portmanteau is. It's where you get two words and you mash them together. Ideally, they overlap in some way. So you take a sort of a letter from the middle of one word and you cross it over with a letter from the middle of the other word and you end up with one nice cohesive blob. In fact, you know who describes what a portmanteau is best, Jess?
Probably the creator of them, wouldn't you say? Or at least the person who coined the word.
Yeah, indeed. And that is a certain Lewis Carroll of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland fame. So yes, a portmanteau did exist before he coined the term portmanteau word. I'll get into what a portmanteau literally is in a second, but let's talk about this idea of the portmanteau word, because the way that Lewis Carroll describes it in his poem, well, the introduction to his poem, The Hunting of the Snark, is really elegant. He says, Humpty Dumpty's theory of two meanings packed into one word, like a portmanteau, seems to me the right explanation for all. For instance, so this is where he really explains it. Take the two words fuming and furious. Make up your mind that you will say both words, but leave it unsettled which you will say first. If you have the rarest of gifts, a perfectly balanced mind, you will say frumious.
That's wonderful. I love Lewis Carroll. I'm always looking out for my white rabbit to take me over to Wonderland. And I love the way he's described this. Now, he didn't coin the word portmanteau as a word in general, but as a term for this type of mashup word. What does it mean literally?
So it comes from French. It comes from the French porter, meaning to carry, and manteau, which means, well, nowadays it means a coat, but a better translation of it is mantle. In fact, that word mantle comes directly from there. And nowadays, a portmanteau is a bag or a case that you might, I suppose, carry your coat in. But originally, a portmanteau was a person. It was a person who would follow someone around with high status and carry their robes for them. Namely, the King of France had his own portmanteau. And that's where the phrase comes from. It's a little bit difficult to then see how and why Lewis Carroll has applied it to this type of word. But I think the idea is that it's kind of a carry-all. It's doing more than its fair share. It's carrying something. Did you have a theory on that one, Jess?
That was my interpretation too. I also like the association with the traveling bag. You can carry two meanings in one word. It's very handy.
That's very good. One word, carrying two meanings. That is good. Portmanteau is itself, you know, a mashing together of two words, but it's not strictly a portmanteau. It's more just a compound.
Right. It's a compound. There's a little bit of overlap there. And we'll talk a little bit about that down the line too. But some of my favorite portmanteaus appear in Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky poem, which appeared in full in Alice's sequel Through the Looking Glass and implies a heroic quest to slay a beast called the Jabberwock. And some of the words, of course, are entirely meaningless, but many are portmanteaus. And as described by Carroll, they are supposed to be understandable based on assumptions about the words that make them up. And then some of them have actually become words that we use now. So we've got funny ones that we don't necessarily use so much, like slithy, which is lie, then slimy together. but we actually use words like galumph, which is a blend of gallop and triumph. And chortle has entered common usage as a blend of chuckle and snort, but both of these originated in his work.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And chortle's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's taking an element of one and actually it's sandwiching it between
smashes it in the middle.
Two parts of the other one, but it still counts, right? Oh, that's wonderful.
Some others that I don't think are specific to Carroll, in fact, I'm pretty sure they're not, but we use the word splatter, and it's originally a combination of splash and spatter, and then stash is an 18th century mashup of stow and cash, which I think is very neat.
No way. You're blowing my mind with these. I knew you'd be really good at finding the ones that I was surprised by. I mean, I've got a huge list of them here, but I don't know if they're going to come as any great surprise to people. But you know, things like brunch, I think people know that that is breakfast and lunch combined, but perhaps people don't realize that there's a name for doing that. And it is portmanteau. Also to be hangry, food, a lot of food portmanteau. Oh, by the way, are we pluralizing it as portmanteaus or in the French way, portmanteau?
I struggle with this so much. I always want to put the X on it because it makes more sense in French, but I still want to pronounce it portmanteaus like you would in English.
I prefer to just go with a nice English plural, slap an S on the end. No one gets confused. You know how many there are. Just a slight aside here. I once went with my wife, who is French, to a pretty down market restaurant in my hometown of Derby. Anyone who's been to Derby will, I'm sure, find it very hard to imagine there's a down market restaurant there. Not. Anyway, they had on the menu for dessert strawberry gâteau with an X at the end of it.
Multiple ghettos.
Yeah, exactly. So my wife ordered it. And then when it came and there was only one cake, she said, but the menu says there are multiple cakes.
False advertising.
Please, darling, don't. Please don't. They're not going to get it.
Sacré bleu.
Anyway, so that left her to some extent hangry, perhaps, both hungry and angry, having not had enough strawberry cake. But then you've also got spork, which is a spoon and a fork. That's a portmanteau. Mocktail, there's one, you know, a mock cocktail. That's a very good one, actually, a very elegant one. And another one that I've come across, it's a three-way portmanteau, and I actually can't think of another three-way portmanteau, so I'll be interested if you can. It is the horrific turducken.
Oh, boy. That's a monstrosity, both of culinary proportions and linguistic proportions.
Have you ever had one?
I have not had one. I'm cautiously interested, but I kind of feel like it's so egregious that I'm not sure that the execution could ever live up to the drama of its own existence.
I don't want to sound English and snobby, but it sounds to me like this has to be an American invention.
I mean, that absolutely makes sense. Okay, so my husband he's going to Disneyland this week, and he's very excited to get the pickle corn dog, which is a hot dog with a pickle wrapped around it, battered and deep fried. So yes, absolutely. The turducken sounds like an American invention.
Just fit as many foods together as you can. And so, by the way, turducken is a deboned chicken stuffed inside a deboned duck stuffed inside a deboned turkey. A turducken.
What a disaster.
Other foods, the cronut as well, which I find it very hard to imagine was invented by the French.
Yeah, yeah, I believe that. And especially, I want to say donuts are also, like, although they're inspired by many European dishes, I believe they were popularized in New York.
Oh, really?
I mean, maybe only certain varieties of them. Every time I riff on this without actually having a source, I end up embarrassing myself. So let's not take my word for this. But I do recall reading about donuts, or at least the term being popularized in the US.
We've noticed that nature and food are not necessarily our strong points, are they? By the way, donuts are a big sore point here in Germany, you know, because there's two ideas. You know, everyone says, oh, you know, when JFK said, "Ich bin ein Berliner," he was supposedly saying, "I am a donut," right? I mean, that is kind of correct, right? The name for the sort of donut that is kind of a jam-filled puff ball, right? That is called a Berliner in a lot of Germany, but not in Berlin. In Berlin, it's called a Pfannkuchen, which means pancake, which is even more confusing because a pancake should not be that round.
So
should not be that three-dimensional.
So everybody in Berlin kind of understood what he was talking about.
Yeah, they knew that. And it was more likely that he meant that he was someone who lived in Berlin. I mean, yeah, that is what people in Berlin call themselves. They call themselves Berliners. Anyway, we digressed, as we always do. Well,
now that we're on politics, though, one of my favorite portmanteaus is gerrymander. Are you familiar with this one?
Ooh, it's ringing a bell, but go on.
So gerrymandering is where you redraw voting districts to benefit a certain candidate. And it's named after Elbridge Gerry, the Massachusetts governor in 1812, who would later be vice president under James Madison. And he created a very convoluted, some even the way it's drawn in illustrations from the time, draw it as a dragon, which a salamander was a dragon-like fire beast before it was a word for a little real critter. And so the word mashes up his name, Gerry, and salamander into gerrymander to capture this nonsense shape.
That's wonderful. So that's a political one. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there must be more political ones. I can certainly think of a few from the world of economics and a few that have become very relevant in recent years without wishing to talk shop too much, but shrinkflation is one of them.
Absolutely.
And you've also got slumpflation as well. Slumpflation, I guess, is an economic slump combined with high inflation.
Let's not economy shame here.
you could also have stagflation as well. If your economy is sort of just bumbling along, not really growing at all, you've got high inflation.
Oh, like stagnant. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Stagnant inflation.
At first I heard stag and I was like the deer.
No, it's as in stagnant, but it's not good. For me, it's not a good portmanteau because there's no crossover of the letters between stagnant and inflation that's been played on there.
Yeah, they're more fun when they fully combine to create a new funny.
In fact, all of these, shrinkflation's all right because you kind of got that in thing going on, but slumpflation, a lot of these I'm not very happy with. A much better one from the world of economics, the word of mathematics, I suppose, although you really probably shouldn't be deploying it too often, is guesstimate. That one works very nicely.
Yeah, that one flows pleasantly, though I think its usage in the corporate world has put me off to it just a little bit.
I mean, I just wouldn't use it, right? I would just use guess or estimate.
Right.
There are a few like this and they seem utterly pointless to me. I'm thinking of chillax. Like to chill and relax are the same thing. Ginormous is another one.
Yeah.
Gigantic and enormous, kind of the same thing. Dystrophy as well. If you really want to stress something's bad, I guess dystrophy is good. But, you know, catastrophe, disaster, you're kind of just getting at the same thing twice.
Mm-hmm. One of the cuter ones that I've seen is adorkable, which I think both of us really are.
Yes, we are. And that word is also adorkable in itself.
It is. There is one like really harrowing one, like not to, you know, throw off the mood, but the word electrocute. originally was a portmanteau. It's first recorded in 1889 in reference to executions by electric chair. So it's this morbid combo of electric and execute.
Yeah, I genuinely had no idea that that was a portmanteau. I just thought, I mean, it works. It's so slipped into our not everyday vernacular, but you know, we use it often enough.
Absolutely. Any other interesting ones come to mind?
Well, while we're talking about technology, breathalyzer is one, a breath analyzer. More modern ones, frenemy, sexting. So you can sext your frenemy if you wish. And also, you know, in the world of linguistics where we dabble, you've got here in Germany, we talk about Denglish when someone mixes their Deutsch and their English, their German and their English, and Spanglish.
Franglais, as I've heard.
Franglais, like these. Yeah, yeah. Well, all of those. Oh, and another one that I found that I'd never come across, you know, in actual usage, but that I rather like is insinuendo.
Oh, I like that one a lot. That's very good.
This is kind of a favorite of the early 20th century, you know, of the wits, of the wags. So it's to insinuate something via innuendo. I found a quote from 1921. "Anyone more cunning I've never seen. Nasty insinuendos enough to make anyone sick."
Beautiful.
That was a guy called Sir Edward Montagu Anthony Compton Mackenzie.
I might need to include that one in the next edition of Words from Hell. It's just too good.
It is good, isn't it? Insinuendo, to insinuate with innuendo.
Were there any others that particularly tickled your fancy in the world of portmanteaus?
Well, while we're talking about tickling, there is one that made me and a lot of my friends laugh when we were at school, because a couple of decades ago, Nissan, they ran a campaign called "Do You Speak Micra?" to advertise the Nissan Micra car, this very small little car. And the advert was just them coining portmanteaus. And I don't remember all of them. One of the ones that I remember they coined was, "It's both spacious and safe. It's spafe."
It's, oh dear. I don't like that at all.
It's a horrible word, isn't it?
Spafe.
Yeah, not into spafe at all. But so we had a lot of fun in the playground coining our own. For example, "It's shiny and bright. It's..." Well, people can work that one out for themselves.
Spiny or briny. But yeah, those mean different things too.
That's what we meant for sure.
Oh, that's good. Very nice. Very nice.
Any more for any more, Jess?
One that I think is interesting. I don't know that you might call this a portmanteau because we've entirely lost the concept that made it up. But the word bridle is lying about being an adjective, and it is a mashup of words. And you might even say it's more of a compound. We have the noun bride, and we have the corresponding adjective bridal, and we have the noun groom, but we don't have groomal. I mean, you can have it and you can use it if you want, but like typically people don't. And one of the reasons is because bridal has been lying about being an adjective for 800 years. It looks, for all intents and purposes, as if it has that French-derived AL ending on it, just like logical, except this isn't as logical, because it doesn't have a suffix at all. What it is, it's a combination of the words bride and ale, because in Middle English, you could combine a word with the word ale to turn it into a party. So a scythe ale, for example, was a harvest party after you had people, you know, cutting down wheat and such. And same with bride. A bride ale was a party thrown for a bride, which I think is super interesting. And it got mashed up into one word. It was treated as a compound word, but it was misinterpreted as an adjective as like Norman French took over and evolved English into early modern English.
Right. So bridal wear should technically then be anything you can wear to a bridal party of sorts, to which would mean that basically fellas can go into the bridal wear section.
I certainly think so. I mean, it's definitely now treated entirely as an adjective, but I do think, you know, since it is an adjective, it should have, we should have more options for groom to have an adjective corresponding to it, you know, groomal, groomulous, groomulific, whatever you like.
Groomulous. I like groomulous.
<laughs> So when we create portmanteaus, we're essentially taking apart words and putting them back together. But that isn't always a feature of portmanteaus. There are other types of words that also involve rearranging, disassembling, and reassembling words into different combinations. And one of those phenomena is called rebracketing. Can you tell us what rebracketing is?
I sure can. So I actually think the name is quite helpful here, because you have to imagine brackets moving around, like, you know, like brackets when you type things and, you know, you put them around things for people who are listening. I'm doing very, very helpful finger gestures for those who are watching.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So this happens usually when you have two words that appear alongside each other very often. And what rebracketing causes to happen is for letters or sounds between those words to switch places. To explain this a bit better, let me take a really good example. So we have the word umpire now, right? And we say an umpire. But originally in the Middle English word was not umpire, it was numpire. But what has happened is through rebracketing, the N at the start of numpire has moved to the end of the A, of the article there, and we've got an umpire. And there are more of these in the English language than you might think.
Tons. For instance, one of my favorites is helicopter, because we tend to tack the ending copter onto other helicopter adjacent words like gyrocopter. It's easy to assume that the word breaks down into the elements heli and copter, but it's actually more like helico plus ter, because it's made up of the Greek elements helix, meaning spiral, and pteron, meaning wing, same as the word pterodactyl. So a helicopter is a spiral wing, literally speaking. And same with a pterodactyl means wing finger, which I think is adorable. The silent P in pterodactyl, by the way, wasn't silent in Greek, but it is silent in English due to what we call phonotactics, or yeah, like the rules of pronunciation. English doesn't like P's and T's next to each other at the beginning of a word, so we just pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Like we do with G's and N's. We don't like gn and kn anymore. Mm-hmm. We used to be all right with
right,
it,
we not, used to love it.
Not these days. We're not into it at all. So that's interesting. That's rebracketing within a word, right? But along the lines of what I was talking about with umpire, this sort of rebracketing between the indefinite article, at or an, and the noun is perhaps the most common way that you see this in English. So you also have it in the fact that an apron was originally a napron.
That N just scooted over.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we get the word napron ultimately from French, and to this day the French word for a tablecloth is une nappe, right? It's N-A-P-P-E. And also apron is related to the word napkin. Napkin is just a small tablecloth, a small nap. So yeah, it was originally a napron. Also, did you know that the UK only has one poisonous snake?
Correction.
It's editing Rob here. I know I just said poisonous when I should have said venomous. Sorry, just thought I'd get ahead of that one.
End of the correction.
I didn't know that. What kind of snake is it?
It's
an adder.
An adder. There you go. Or as it originally was, a nadder. And indeed in German over here, it's called eine Natter, right? So it's still got that N at the start of it. But it doesn't always work that way. It's not always the a that's sucking away the N from the noun. The reverse has happened with the word newt, because a newt was originally an ute. Ta-da!
Interesting. And that's, we also see this phenomenon with nickname, right? Which was originally an eke name. Eke means additional. So a nickname is an additional name, and it's been misinterpreted and rearranged and rebracketed into nickname, with folk etymology influencing the name Nick on it.
Yeah, Nick is associated with the devil, right? Mm-hmm. And when it pops up, it's usually a reference to the devil. So I wonder if that's sort of folk etymology is invoking the idea of it being a sort of devilish alternative name. Actually, in Swedish, I notice you can still say uknamn. I will not be pronouncing that correctly, but it begins with an O with an umlaut over the top of it. And yeah, no N at the start of that term either.
Interesting. That's cool. And so, yeah, I wonder if it is that like devilish sense Nick ends up in idioms due for the same reason as like Jack does. Both of them were kind of generic names, Nick with more of that devilish twist, but it's also short for Nicholas. So it's difficult to say what exactly inspired that re-bracketing and re-spelling.
I'm thinking of Devil's Fart Bread, Pumpernickel.
Oh, yes. Goblin fart, right?
And a lot of this re-bracketing happens during the Middle English period. And we've been left with so many of these slightly wrong words, if I can use the word wrong. Yeah, why not? I mean, they're a result of a mistake, of a misunderstanding. But thankfully, not all of them made it through to modern English. For example, there are citations of the word nostrich instead of ostrich in Middle English. It should be ostrich. There's also napple as well. So I think some people, some places on the internet will tell you that our word apple should be napple. It shouldn't. It should be apple. But there are moments where it has been written as napple, but I guess we should say erroneously. And also there are examples of talking about a neg instead of an egg.
I mean, it makes sense if you've heard people say it before you wrote it down, and that's the only time you've ever encountered the phrase.
Which would have been the case for most people, right? This is the only, you know, the printing press is, what, just invented or not yet invented for most of the Middle English period. So people won't have seen this written down. No one's literate, you know, so they're just making the best of it. The best of it that they can. One that I couldn't quite get to the bottom of. So I was looking, as one does, at Robert Cordry's Table Alphabetical. You know about this, one of the very, very,
absolutely,
very first, if not the first, dictionary, right? It's just a list of slightly obscure terms, usually terms from Latin or French, and a very, very brief explanation of what they mean. And in there is the word annoyance.
Like an annoyance?
Yeah, exactly. Which is annoyance. So it's rather than an annoyance, which is really awkward to say, and you can see why. But why I say I couldn't get to the bottom of that one is that both of those existed in Old French. So both nuance and annoyance exist in French. So it may not be our fault, basically.
That makes sense. A couple other examples of the phenomenon we see in helicopter, where words get pulled apart and put back together, almost to create portmanteaus or to create compounds, depending on how collectively the term is assembled, are, say, hamburger. The burger ending gets attached to like cheeseburger and things along those lines, and, you know, bacon burger, or simply it's a standalone word. But of course, that's a rebracketing from Hamburg. So, you know, burger wasn't necessarily, much like the Berliner. That's the same logic behind the original hamburger. It's a sandwich purportedly from Hamburg.
Yeah, there is no German town of Cheeseburg.
Right,
there
exactly.
Is no Austrian town of Baconburg, probably.
Another interesting one is cybernetics. Cyber is incorrectly, well, I guess not necessarily incorrectly, but misinterpreted as being the part of that you can take off and put onto things like cyberspace. But if you were going based on the full Greek root, it would be cybern that would be attached. But that makes it a little awkward, with like cybern space is a little more awkward than cyberspace. Another fun one is alcoholic gets rebracketed. The hall gets pulled over into the ending that's then tacked onto words like workaholic. But of course, alcohol is an Arabic derived, or at least partially Arabic derived term. The part that would come off is the AL part, because that's the definite article in Arabic.
Yeah, if you see a word starting with AL and you're not sure where it comes from,
probably Arabic.
Look to Arabic, usually. You know what some people are going to be shouting? They're going to be shouting, orange, orange. Why haven't you mentioned orange?
Of course. Yeah.
We should talk about orange. Was an orange ever an orange?
An orange. My understanding is that it wasn't, but there was a word that began with N in another language that did inspire it.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Okay, let me get to the nub of this. No, there has never been an orange in the English language. That has never been the case, right? Nor has it been in French. Obviously, we get that word from French. But if you go back far enough, because people will be thinking, yeah, but it's naranja in Spanish. And you're like, yes, yes. This is all about how long it takes the orange to get from Asia, South Asia, to the British Isles or to Western Europe, right? Because in Sanskrit, which is, I think, the earliest language that we know the word from, it's narangas. And in Persian and Arabic, it was narang and naranj, mm-hmm. right? So you can see that, yeah, it really does start with an N. All I'm saying is that that N does not disappear in English. We don't lose that N through our own ignorance and our own confusion with an orange. It happens, it would appear, sometime while the Italians are in possession of the orange, because that's where that N disappears from the start. And then they hand the orange over to the French, and the French hand the orange over to the English, giving us a new word to describe that particular hue, which up until this point we've been calling something like yellow red.
And it was the color is the name of, is named after the fruit, right? That's yeah. where we got that. And then the fruit after the tree, it's a naranja, or a tree. The tree was called the naranja, or the any of the other words that you cited there, which we'll have to talk about color words on a future episode, because they get all kinds of crazy.
They really do. Oh, by the way, on oranges, the French called it a pomme d'orange, which is an orange apple.
Orange
which
apple. Mm-hmm.
Fits in with what you were saying about it being named after the tree rather than, it's the fruit of the orange tree.
A lot of fruits and vegetables have been called apples in the past. I've also, cucumbers at one point were called earth apples or something along those lines. And potatoes, of course, pomme de terre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Completely true. Cucumbers were apples.
There is one cute one that I think a lot of people will like, because everybody loves dogs. And you know, if you thought about this hard enough, then you'd probably realize it yourself. But you know the term like labradoodle.
Yeah.
And when you combine combine dog breeds, and one is a poodle, it becomes a something doodle, a golden doodle, a whatever doodle.
I actually have a big list of these that I should have mentioned when we were talking about portmanteaus, right? Because some of them are legit portmanteaus. Like a puggle, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a pug and a beagle.
The doodle, the D on the doodle is the rebracketed part, because it comes from not poodle, which starts with a P, but labradoodle. So every doodle that has been named that after labradoodle is taking that D from Labrador rather than inventing one and tacking it onto poodle.
I actually think a lot of these names aren't very satisfying. For example, a cockapoo. It should be a cockapoodle, right? Why does it just end with poo?
It sounds like a bird to me.
Yeah, oh, that's true. I mean, that is mm-hmm. why they've done that. Yeah, you're right. It's to make it sound like a bird. But what about I've got to be really careful with this one. A cross between a shih tzu and a poodle is called a shih-poo.
Shih-poo.
shih-poo. But I think you're right. That poo is probably a reference to a cockapoo rather than a poodle, if you know what I mean.
That would make sense.
They do it once and then they just get oh so carried away.
All these poods and dudes showing up everywhere.
Can I talk about metathesis?
Yes, let's do it.
The other baffling linguistic term that we used up top, but it's not that scary. So we've been talking about when letters swap between words, but when they swap around within words, that's called metathesis. A good example of this is how you sometimes hear people say ax instead of ask. I'd say that in a slight sort of London accent, like the modern London accent is very common to say I ox you instead of I ask you. That's metathesis. You see how the K and the S sound have swapped around.
That also happens a lot in American dialects.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So many people are quick to point out that it's to say that it's incorrect, but it's correct in that dialect.
Yeah. Although what I do not really get on board with is when you will hear people saying, well, you know, in old English, it could be ASCIAN or AXIAN, as if people are invoking the old English forms of the word when they
yeah,
say
I don't think,
it's
I don't
not
think
that.
So. That's a stretch.
It's just the same phenomenon happening twice, once in the 11th century or whatever, and once in the 21st century. And I think that's kind of neat in its own way.
It's also a cute thing that kids do too. Like my cousin used to say biscotti instead of spaghetti.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. And we do it more than you might think as well. For example, a lot of people will say comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Instead of comfortable.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It works better in an American accent, like with that sort of roticity. Would it be comfortable?
It would be ridiculous for me to say comfortable. Like,
exactly. Yeah, but I would say comfortable, mm-hmm. which is just, you know, as we tend to do in British English, just to skip half of the sounds anyway. And also you get it when, actually, to be honest, have I ever heard anyone say purdy instead of pretty?
I would say that I say that to my dog a good bit.
Oh, okay. Adorable. Well, that's the cutest form of metathesis that I can think of. Although there is more cuteness in the fact that a bird was originally a brid.
Yeah, that's right.
Less cute was a wasp. Was a waps in Old English and in Middle English. Actually, my favorite form of that word is wappies, one of the Middle English forms of a wasp.
That is adorable. And I don't know, maybe kind of describes wappies.
I might hate them less if they were called wappies.
Right.
But as it is, I detest them.
I agreed.
Oh, and the word third, which rhymes with bird.
Thrid.
Thrid, indeed. Mm. Yeah, spelt with that lovely thorn letter from Old and Middle English.
I do think there's an interesting phenomenon when portmanteaus and word-forming elements change meaning because of the way that they are pulled off of another word. One example of this is verse from universe. Now it's tacked on to words like Buffyverse, metaverse, hooniverse, universe, things like that. But the verse element, the universe, originally means one turn, giving it the literal meaning like turned into one. So verse means turn, but over time, it has become a word-forming element meaning world or realm, which is pretty neat. Apparently, the first person to apply verse to other things, according to some sources, is Orson Scott Card of the Ender's Game universe, which became the Enderverse. However, I contest that usage because philosopher William James coined multiverse using the same element in the 1890s, and it works very similarly.
So multiverse is to have multiple universes, mm-hmm. isn't it? Which is a weird sort of oxymoron.
Compound portmanteau.
It's a mess. You should just say multiple universes. Would it be so hard? It'd be so hard. But if we took that attitude, we wouldn't have any portmanteau at all. And actually, as we've learnt during this edition of Words Unraveled, a portmanteau can be a beautiful thing.
So much fun. It's one of my favorite topics.
Thanks a lot for listening or watching this edition of Words Unraveled. Do leave comments below if you're watching this on YouTube, or you can email us on wordsunraveledpod@gmail.com.
Don't forget to share your favorite portmanteaus, either ones that you've invented or ones that you've come across in real life. We'll see you next time.
Cheery bye.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Pro Savings Days are back at Lowe's. MyLowe's Pro Rewards members save even more with limited-time doorbuster deals. Save $5 on 24-count Contractor's Choice 42-gallon trash bags, now just $14.78. Plus, get your choice select DeWalt Elite Series saw blades for $9.98. Not a Pro Rewards member? Join for free today at Lowe's. Valid through 9/17. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.